Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
From unsolved mysteries to unexplained phenomena, from comedy gold to relationship fails, Amazon Music's got the most ad-free top podcasts, included with Prime. Download the Amazon Music app today.
Chapter 4 of Ethan Frome. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Bob Neufeld. Ethan Frome by Edith Wharton. Chapter 4. As soon as his wife had driven off, Ethan took his coat and cap from the peg. Matty was washing up the dishes, humming one of the dance tunes of the night before. He said, "So long, Matt." And she answered gaily, "So long, Ethan." And that was all. It was warm and bright in the kitchen. The sun slanted through the south window on the girl's moving figure, on the cat dozing in a chair, and on the geraniums brought in from the doorway, where Ethan had planted them in the summer to make a garden for Matty. He would have liked to linger on, watching her tidy up and then settle down to her sewing, but he wanted still more to get the hauling done and be back at the farm before night. All the way down to the village he continued to think of his return to Matty. The kitchen was a poor place, not spruce and shining as his mother had kept it in his boyhood, but it was surprising what a home-like look the mere fact of Zina's absence gave it, and he pictured what it would be like that evening when he and Matty were there after supper. For the first time they would be alone together indoors, and they would sit there, one on each side of the stove, like a married couple. He in his stocking feet and smoking his pipe, she laughing and talking in that funny way she had, which was always as new to him as if he had never heard her before. The sweetness of the picture, and the relief of knowing that his fears of trouble with Zina were unfounded, sent up his spirits with a rush, and he, who was usually so silent, whistled and sang aloud as he drove through the snowy fields. There was in him a slumbering spark of sociability which the long Starkfield winters had not yet extinguished. By nature grave and inarticulate, he admired recklessness and gaiety in others, and was warmed to the marrow by friendly human intercourse. At Worcester, though he had the name of keeping to himself and not being much of a hand at a good time, he had secretly gloried in being clapped on the back and hailed as Old Eth or Old Stiff, and the cessation of such familiarities had increased the chill of his return to Starkfield. There the silence had deepened about him year by year. Left alone after his father's accident to carry the burden of farm and mill, he had had no time for convivial loiterings in the village. And when his mother fell ill, the loneliness of the house grew more oppressive than that of the fields. His mother had been a talker in her day, but after her trouble, the sound of her voice was seldom heard, though she had not lost the power of speech. Sometimes, in the long winter evenings, when in desperation her son asked her why she didn't say something, she would lift a finger and answer, "Because I'm listening." And on stormy nights, when the loud wind was about the house, she would complain, if he spoke to her, "They're talking so out there that I can't hear you." It was only when she drew toward her last illness, and his cousin Zenobia Pierce came over from the next valley to help him nurse her, that human speech was heard again in the house. After the mortal silence of his long imprisonment, Zina's volubility was music in his ears. He felt that he might have gone like his mother if the sound of a new voice had not come to steady him. Zina seemed to understand his case at a glance. She laughed at him for not knowing the simplest sickbed duties, and told him to go right along out and leave her to see to things. The mere fact of obeying her orders, of feeling free to go about his business again and talk with other men, restored his shaken balance and magnified his sense of what he owed her. Her efficiency shamed and dazzled him. She seemed to possess by instinct all the household wisdom that his long apprenticeship had not instilled in him. When the end came, it was she who had to tell him to hitch up and go for the undertaker, and she thought it funny that he had not settled beforehand who was to have his mother's clothes and the sewing machine. After the funeral, when he saw her preparing to go away, he was seized with an unreasoning dread of being left alone on the farm, and before he knew what he was doing, he had asked her to stay there with him. He had often thought since that it would not have happened if his mother had died in spring instead of winter. When they married, it was agreed that as soon as he could straighten out the difficulties resulting from Mrs. Frome's long illness, they would sell the farm and sawmill and try their luck in a large town. Ethan's love of nature did not take the form of a taste for agriculture. He had always wanted to be an engineer and to live in towns where there were lectures and big libraries and fellows doing things. A slight engineering job in Florida, put in his way during his period of study at Worcester, increased his faith in his ability, as well as his eagerness to see the world, and he felt sure that, with a smart wife like Zina, it would not be long before he had made himself a place in it. Zina's native village was slightly larger and nearer to the railway than Starkfield, and she had let her husband see from the first that life on an isolated farm was not what she had expected when she married. But purchasers were slow in coming, and while he waited for them, Ethan learned the impossibility of transplanting her. She chose to look down on Starkfield, but she could not have lived in a place which looked down on her. Even Bettsbridge or Shadd's Falls would not have been sufficiently aware of her, and in the greater cities which attracted Ethan, she would have suffered a complete loss of identity. And within a year of their marriage, she developed the sickliness which had since made her notable even in a community rich in pathological instances. When she came to take care of his mother, she had seemed to Ethan like the very genius of health. But he soon saw that her skill as a nurse had been acquired by the absorbed observation of her own symptoms. Then she too fell silent. Perhaps it was the inevitable effect of life on the farm, or perhaps, as she sometimes said, it was because Ethan never listened. The charge was not wholly unfounded. When she spoke, it was only to complain, and to complain of things not in his power to remedy. And to check a tendency to impatient retort, he had first formed the habit of not answering her, and finally of thinking of other things while she talked. Of late, however, since he had reasons for observing her more closely, her silence had begun to trouble him. He recalled his mother's growing taciturnity, and wondered if Zina were also turning queer. Women did, he knew. Zina, who had at her fingers' ends the pathological chart of the whole region, had cited many cases of the kind while she was nursing his mother, and he himself knew of certain lonely farmhouses in the neighborhood where stricken creatures pined, and of others where sudden tragedy had come of their presence. At times, looking at Zina's shut face, he felt the chill of such forebodings. At other times, her silence seemed deliberately assumed to conceal far-reaching intentions, mysterious conclusions drawn from suspicions and resentments impossible to guess. That supposition was even more disturbing than the other, and it was the one which had come to him the night before, when he had seen her standing in the kitchen door. Now her departure for Bettsbridge had once more eased his mind, and all his thoughts were on the prospect of his evening with Mattie. Only one thing weighed on him, and that was his having told Zina that he was to receive cash for the lumber. He foresaw so clearly the consequences of this imprudence that with considerable reluctance he decided to ask Andrew Hale for a small advance on his load. When Ethan drove into Hale's yard, the builder was just getting out of his sleigh. "Hello, Eath," he said. "This comes handy." Andrew Hale was a ruddy man, with a big gray mustache and a stubbly double chin unconstrained by a collar. But his scrupulously clean shirt was always fastened by a small diamond stud. This display of opulence was misleading, for though he did a fairly good business, it was known that his easy-going habits and the demands of his large family frequently kept him what Starkfield called behind. He was an old friend of Ethan's family, and his house was one of the few to which Zina occasionally went, drawn there by the fact that Mrs. Hale, in her youth, had done more doctoring than any other woman in Starkfield, and was still a recognized authority on symptoms and treatment. Hale went up to the Grays and patted their sweating flanks. "Well, sir," he said, "you keep them too as if they was pets." Ethan set about unloading the logs, and when he had finished his job, he pushed open the glazed door of the shed which the builder used as his office. Hale sat with his feet up on the stove, his back propped against a battered desk strewn with papers. The place, like the man, was warm, genial, and untidy. "Sit right down and thaw out," he greeted Ethan. The latter did not know how to begin, but at length he managed to bring out his request for an advance of $50. The blood rushed to his thin skin under the sting of Hale's astonishment. It was the builder's custom to pay at the end of 3 months, and there was no precedent between the two men for a cash settlement. Ethan felt that if he had pleaded an urgent need, Hale might have made shift to pay him, but pride and an instinctive prudence kept him from resorting to this argument. After his father's death, it had taken time to get his head above water, and he did not want Andrew Hale, or anyone else in Starkfield, to think he was going under again. Besides, he hated lying. If he wanted the money, he wanted it, and it was nobody's business to ask why. He therefore made his demand with the awkwardness of a proud man who will not admit to himself that he is stooping, and he was not much surprised at Hale's refusal. The builder refused genially, as he did everything else. He treated the matter as something in a matter of a practical joke, and wanted to know if Ethan meditated buying a grand piano or adding a cupola to his house, offering in the latter case to give his services free of cost. Ethan's arts were soon exhausted, and after an embarrassed pause he wished Hale good day and opened the door of the office. As he passed out, the builder suddenly called after him, "See here, you ain't in a tight place, are you?" "Not a bit," Ethan's pride retorted before his reason had time to intervene. "Well, that's good, because I am a shade. Fact is, I was going to ask you to give me a little extra time on that payment. Business is pretty slack to begin with, and then I'm fixing up a little house for Ned and Ruth when they're married. I'm glad to do it for 'em, but it costs." His look appealed to Ethan for sympathy. "The young people like things nice. You know how it is yourself. It's not so long ago since you fixed up your own place for Zina." Ethan left the Grays in Hale's stable and went about some other business in the village. As he walked away, the builder's last phrase lingered in his ears, and he reflected grimly that his 7 years with Zina seemed to Starkfield not so long. The afternoon was drawing to an end, and here and there a lighted pane spangled the cold gray dusk and made the snow look whiter. The bitter weather had driven everyone indoors, and Ethan had the long rural street to himself. Suddenly he heard the brisk play of sleigh bells, and a cutter passed him, drawn by a free-going horse. Ethan recognized Michael Eady's roan colt, and young Dennis Eady, in a handsome new fur cap, leaned forward and waved a greeting. "Hello, Eath!" he shouted, and spun on. The cutter was going in the direction of the Frome farm, and Ethan's heart contracted as he listened to the dwindling bells. What more likely than that Dennis Eady had heard of Zena's departure for Bettsbridge, and was profiting by the opportunity to spend an hour with Matty? Ethan was ashamed of the storm of jealousy in his breast. It seemed unworthy of the girl that his thoughts of her should be so violent. He walked on to the church corner, and entered the shade of the Varnum spruces, where he had stood with her the night before. As he passed into their gloom, he saw an indistinct outline just ahead of him. At his approach, it melted for an instant into two separate shapes, and then conjoined again, and he heard a kiss and a half-laughing, "Oh!" provoked by the discovery of his presence. Again the outline hastily disunited, and the Varnum gate slammed on one half, while the other hurried on ahead of him. Ethan smiled at the discomfiture he had caused. What did it matter to Ned Hale and Ruth Varnum if they were caught kissing each other? Everybody in Starkfield knew they were engaged. It pleased Ethan to have surprised a pair of lovers on the spot where he and Maddie had stood with such a thirst for each other in their hearts, and he felt a pang at the thought that these two need not hide their happiness. He fetched the grays from Hale's stable and started on his long climb back to the farm. The cold was less sharp than earlier in the day, and a thick, fleecy sky threatened snow for the morrow. Here and there a star pricked through, showing behind it a deep well of blue. In an hour or two the moon would push over the ridge behind the farm, burn a gold-edged rent in the clouds, and then be swallowed by them. A mournful peace hung on the fields, as though they felt the relaxing grasp of the cold, and stretched themselves in their long winter sleep. Ethan's ears were alert for the jingle of sleigh bells, but not a sound broke the silence of the lonely road. As he drew near the farm, he saw, through the thin screen of larches at the gate, a light twinkling in the house above him. "She's up in her room," he said to himself, "fixing herself up for supper." And he remembered Zena's sarcastic stare when Matty, on the evening of her arrival, had come down to supper with smooth hair and a ribbon at her neck. He passed by the graves on the knoll and turned his head to glance at one of the older headstones, which had interested him deeply as a boy because it bore his name. "Sacred to the memory of Ethan Frome and Endurance, his wife, who dwelled together in peace for 50 years. He used to think that 50 years sounded like a long time to live together, but now it seemed to him that they might pass in a flash. Then, with a sudden dart of irony, he wondered if, when their turn came, the same epitaph would be written over him and Zena. He opened the barn door and craned his head into the obscurity, half fearing to discover Dennis Eady's roan colt in the stall beside the sorrel. But the old horse was there alone, mumbling his crib with toothless jaws, and Ethan whistled cheerfully while he bedded down the grays and shook an extra measure of oats into their mangers. His was not a tuneful throat, but harsh melodies burst from it as he locked the barn and sprang up the hill to the house. He reached the kitchen porch and turned the door handle, but the door did not yield to his touch. Startled at finding it locked, he rattled the handle violently. Then he reflected that Mattie was alone, and that it was natural she should barricade herself at nightfall. He stood in the darkness expecting to hear her step. It did not come, and after vainly straining his ears, he called out in a voice that shook with joy, "Hello, Matt!" Silence answered, but in a minute or two he caught a sound on the stairs and saw a line of light about the door-frame, as he had seen it the night before. So strange was the precision with which the incidents of the previous evening were repeating themselves, that he half expected, when he heard the key turn, to see his wife before him on the threshold. But the door opened, and Mattie faced him. She stood just as Zina had stood, a lifted lamp in her hand against the black background of the kitchen. She held the light at the same level, and it drew out with the same distinctness her slim young throat and the brown wrist no bigger than a child's. Then, striking upward, it threw a lustrous fleck on her lips, edged her eyes with velvet shade, and laid a milky whiteness above the black curve of her brows. She wore her usual dress of darkish stuff, and there was no bow at her neck, but through her hair she had run a streak of crimson ribbon. This tribute to the unusual transformed and glorified her. She seemed to Ethan taller, fuller, more womanly in shape and motion. She stood aside, smiling silently, while he entered, and then moved away from him with something soft and flowing in her gait. She set the lamp on the table, and he saw that it was carefully laid for supper, with fresh doughnuts, stewed blueberries, and his favorite pickles in a dish of gay red glass. A bright fire glowed in the stove, and the cat lay stretched before it, watching the table with a drowsy eye. Ethan was suffocated with a sense of well-being. He went out into the passage to hang up his coat and pull off his wet boots. When he came back, Mattie had set the teapot on the table, and the cat was rubbing itself persuasively against her ankles. "Why, Puss, I nearly tripped over you," she cried, with laughter sparkling through her lashes. Again Ethan felt a sudden twinge of jealousy. Could it be his coming that gave her such a kindled face? "Well, Matt, any visitors?" he threw off, stooping down carelessly to examine the fastening of the stove. She nodded and laughed. "Yes, one." And he felt a blackness settling on his brows. "Who was that?" he questioned, raising himself up to slant a glance at her beneath his scowl. Her eyes danced with malice. "Why, Jotham Powell. He came in after he got back and asked for a drop of coffee before he went down home." The blackness lifted, and light flooded Ethan's brain. "Well, that all? Well, I hope you made out to let him have it." And after a pause, he felt it right to add, "I suppose he got Zina over to the flats all right?"
"Oh, yes, in plenty of time."
The name threw a chill between them, and they stood a moment looking sideways at each other before Mattie said with a shy laugh,
"I guess it's about time for supper."
They drew their seats up to the table, and the cat, unbidden, jumped between them into Zina's empty chair.
"Oh, Puss," said Mattie,
and they laughed again. Ethan, a moment earlier, had felt himself on the brink of eloquence, but the mention of Zina had paralyzed him. Mattie seemed to feel the contagion of his embarrassment, and sat with downcast lids, sipping her tea, while he feigned an insatiable appetite for doughnuts and sweet pickles. At last, after casting about for an effective opening, he took a long gulp of tea, cleared his throat, and said, "Looks as if there'd be more snow." She feigned great interest.
"Is that so? Do you suppose it'll interfere with Zina's getting back?"
She flushed red as the question escaped her, and hastily set down the cup she was lifting. Ethan reached over for another helping of pickles. "You never can tell, this time of year. It drifts so bad on the flats." The name had benumbed him again, and once more he felt as if Zina were in the room between them.
"Oh, Puss, you're too greedy!" Matty cried.
The cat, unnoticed, had crept up on muffled paws from Zina's seat to the table, and was stealthily elongating its body in the direction of the milk jug, which stood between Ethan and Matty. The two leaned forward at the same moment, and their hands met on the handle of the jug. Matty's hand was underneath, and Ethan kept his clasped on it a moment longer than was necessary. The cat, profiting by this unusual demonstration, tried to effect an unnoticed retreat, and in doing so backed into the pickle dish, which fell to the floor with a crash. Matty, in an instant, had sprung from her chair and was down on her knees by the fragments.
"Oh, Ethan! Ethan! It's all to pieces! What will Zina say?"
By this time his courage was up. "Well, she'll have to say it to the cat, anyway," he rejoined with a laugh, kneeling down at Matty's side to scrape up the swimming pickles. She lifted stricken eyes to him.
"Yes, but, you see, she never meant it should be used, not even when there was company. And I had to get up on the step-ladder to reach it down from the top shelf of the china closet, where she keeps it with all her best things. And, of course, she'll want to know why I did it."
The case was so serious that it called forth all of Ethan's latent resolution. "She needn't know anything about it if you keep quiet. I'll get another just like it tomorrow. Where did it come from? I'll go to Shad's Falls for it if I have to."
"Oh, you'll never get another one there. It was a wedding present, don't you remember? It came all the way from Philadelphia, from Zina's aunt that married the minister. That's why she wouldn't ever use it. Oh, Ethan, Ethan, what in the world shall I do?"
She began to cry, and he felt as if every one of her tears were pouring over him like burning lead.
"Don't, Matt, don't. Oh, don't," he implored her.
She struggled to her feet, and he rose and followed her helplessly while she spread out the pieces of glass on the kitchen dresser. It seemed to him as if the shattered fragments of their evening lay there.
"Here, give them to me,"
he said in a voice of sudden authority. She drew aside, instinctively obeying his tone.
"Oh, Ethan, what are we going to do?"
Without replying, he gathered the pieces of glass into his broad palm and walked out of the kitchen to the passage. There he lit a candle end, opened the china closet, and reaching his long arm up to the highest shelf, laid the pieces together with such accuracy of touch that a close inspection convinced him of the impossibility of detecting from below that the dish was broken. If he glued it together the next morning, months might elapse before his wife noticed what had happened, and meanwhile he might after all be able to match the dish at Shad's Falls or Bettsbridge. Having satisfied himself that there was no risk of immediate discovery, he went back to the kitchen with a lighter step, and found Matty disconsolately removing the last scraps of pickle from the floor.
"It's all right, Matt. Come back and finish supper," he commanded her.
Completely reassured, she shone on him through tear-hung lashes, and his soul swelled with pride as he saw how his tone subdued her. She did not even ask what he had done. Except when he was steering a big log down the mountain to his mill, he had never known such a thrilling sense of mastery. End of chapter 4. Chapter 5 of Ethan Frome. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Bob Neufeld. Ethan Frome by Edith Wharton. Chapter 5. They finished supper, and while Matty cleared the table, Ethan went to look at the cows, and then took a last turn about the house. The earth lay dark under a muffled sky, and the air was so still that now and then he heard a lump of snow come thumping down from a tree far off on the edge of the woodlot. When he returned to the kitchen, Matty had pushed up his chair to the stove, and seated herself near the lamp with a bit of sewing. The scene was just as he had dreamed of it that morning. He sat down, drew his pipe from his pocket, and stretched his feet to the glow. His hard day's work in the keen air made him feel at once lazy and light of mood, and he had a confused sense of being in another world where all was warmth and harmony, and time could bring no change. The only drawback to his complete well-being was the fact that he could not see Matty from where he sat, but he was too indolent to move, and after a moment he said, "Come over here and sit by the stove." Zina's empty rocking chair stood facing him. Matty rose obediently and seated herself in it. As her young brown head detached itself against the patchwork cushion that habitually framed his wife's gaunt countenance, Ethan had a momentary shock. It was almost as if the other face, the face of the superseded woman, had obliterated that of the intruder. After a moment, Matty seemed to be affected by the same sense of restraint. She changed her position, leaning forward to bend her head above her work, so that he saw only the foreshortened tip of her nose and the streak of red in her hair. Then she slipped to her feet, saying, "I can't see to sew," and went back to her chair by the lamp. Ethan made a pretext of getting up to replenish the stove, and when he returned to his seat, he pushed it sideways that he might get a view of her profile, and of the lamplight falling on her hands. The cat, who had been a puzzled observer of these unusual movements, jumped up into Zina's chair, rolled itself into a ball, and lay watching them with narrowed eyes. Deep quiet sank on the room. The clock ticked above the dresser, a piece of charred wood fell now and then in the stove, and the faint, sharp scent of the geraniums mingled with the odor of Ethan's smoke, which began to throw a blue haze about the lamp and to hang its grayish cobwebs in the shadowy corners of the room. All constraint vanished between the two, and they began to talk easily and simply. They spoke of everyday things, of the prospect of snow, of the next church sociable, of the loves and quarrels of Starkfield. The commonplace nature of what they said produced in Ethan an illusion of long-established intimacy, which no outburst of emotion could have given, and he set his imagination adrift on the fiction that they had always spent their evenings thus, and would always go on doing so. "This is the night we were to have gone coasting, Matt," he said at length, with the rich sense as he spoke that they could go on any other night they chose, since they had all time before them. She smiled back at him. "I guess you forgot." "No, I didn't forget, but it's as dark as Egypt outdoors. We might go tomorrow, if there's a moon." She laughed with pleasure, her head tilted back, the lamplight sparkling on her lips and teeth. "Oh, that would be lovely, Ethan." He kept his eyes fixed on her, marveling at the way her face changed with each turn of their talk, like a wheat field under a summer breeze. It was intoxicating to find such magic in his clumsy words, and he longed to try new ways of using it. "Would you be scared to go down the Corbury Road with me on a night like this?" he asked. Her cheeks burned redder. "I ain't any more scared than you are." "Well, I'd be scared then. I wouldn't do it. That's an ugly corner down by the big elm. If a fellow didn't keep his eyes open, he'd go plumb into it." He luxuriated in the sense of protection and authority which his words conveyed. To prolong and intensify the feeling, he added, "I guess we're well enough here." She let her lid sink slowly in the way he loved. "Yes, we're well enough here," she sighed. Her tone was so sweet that he took the pipe from his mouth and drew his chair up to the table. Leaning forward, he touched the farther end of the strip of brown stuff that she was hemming. "Say, Matt," he began with a smile, "what do you think I saw under the Varnum spruces coming along home just now? I saw a friend of yours getting kissed." The words had been on his tongue all the evening, but now that he had spoken them, they struck him as inexpressively vulgar and out of place. Matty blushed to the roots of her hair, and pulling her needle rapidly twice or thrice through her work, insensibly drawing the end of it away from him. "I suppose it was Ruth and Ned," she said in a low voice, as though he had suddenly touched on something grave. Ethan had imagined that his allusion might open the way to the accepted pleasantries, and these, perhaps, in turn, to a harmless caress, if only a mere touch on her hand. But now he felt as if her blush had set a flaming guard about her. He supposed it was his natural awkwardness that made him feel so. He knew that most young men made nothing at all of giving a pretty girl a kiss, and he remembered that the night before, when he had put his arm about Matty, she had not resisted. But that had been out of doors, under the open, irresponsible night. Now, in the warm lamplit room, with all its ancient implications of conformity and order, she seemed infinitely farther away from him and more unapproachable. To ease his constraint, he said, "I suppose they'll be setting a date before long." "Yes, I shouldn't wonder if they got married some time along in the summer." She pronounced the word "married" as if her voice caressed it. It seemed a rustling covert leading to enchanted glades. A pang shot through Ethan, and he said, twisting away from her in his chair, "It'll be your turn next, I wouldn't wonder." She laughed a little uncertainly. "Why do you keep on saying that?" He echoed her laugh. "I guess I do it to get used to the idea." He drew up to the table again, and she sewed on in silence, with drooped lashes, while he sat in fascinated contemplation of the way in which her hands went up and down above the strip of stuff, just as he had seen a pair of birds make short perpendicular flights over a nest they were building. At length, without turning her head or lifting her lids, she said in a low tone, "It's not because you think Zina's got anything against me, is it?" His former dread started up full-armed at the suggestion. "Why, what do you mean?" he stammered. She raised distressed eyes to his, her work dropping on the table between them. "I don't know. I thought last night she seemed to have." "I'd like to know what," he growled. "Nobody can tell with Zina." It was the first time they had ever spoken so openly of her attitude toward Matty, and the repetition of the name seemed to carry it to the farther corners of the room and send it back to them in long repercussions of sound. Matty waited, as if to give the echo time to drop, and then went on. "She hasn't said anything to you?" He shook his head. "No, not a word." She tossed the hair back from her forehead with a laugh. "I guess I'm just nervous, then. I'm not going to think about it any more." "Oh, no, don't let's think about it, Matt." The sudden heat of his tone made her color mount again, not with a rush, but gradually, delicately, like the reflection of a thought stealing slowly across her heart. She sat silent, her hands clasped on her work, and it seemed to him that a warm current flowed toward him along the strip of stuff that still lay unrolled between them. Cautiously, he slid his hand palm downward along the table, till his fingertips touched the end of the stuff. A faint vibration of her lashes seemed to show that she was aware of his gesture, and that it had sent a countercurrent back to her, and she let her hands lie motionless on the other end of the strip. As they sat thus, he heard a sound behind him and turned his head. The cat had jumped from Zina's chair to dart at a mouse in the wainscot, and as a result of the sudden movement, the empty chair had set up a spectral rocking. "She'll be rocking in it herself this time tomorrow," Ethan thought. "I've been in a dream, and this is the only evening we'll ever have together." The return to reality was as painful as the return to consciousness after taking an anesthetic. His body and brain ached with indescribable weariness, and he could think of nothing to say or to do that should arrest the mad flight of the moments. His alteration of mood seemed to have communicated itself to Matty. She looked up at him languidly, as though her lids were weighted with sleep, and it cost her an effort to raise them. Her glance fell on his hand, which now completely covered the end of her work, and grasped it as if it were a part of herself. He saw a scarcely perceptible tremor cross her face, and without knowing what he did, he stooped his head and kissed a bit of stuff in his hold. As his lips rested on it, he felt it glide slowly from beneath him, and saw that Matty had risen and was silently rolling up her work. She fastened it with a pin, and then, finding her thimble and scissors, put them with the roll of stuff into the box covered with fancy paper, which he had once brought to her from Bettsbridge. He stood up also, looking vaguely about the room. The clock above the dresser struck 11. "Is the fire all right?" she asked in a low voice. He opened the door of the stove and poked aimlessly at the embers. When he raised himself again, he saw that she was dragging toward the stove the old soap-box lined with carpet in which the cat made its bed. Then she recrossed the floor and lifted two of the geranium pots in her arms, moving them away from the cold window. He followed her and brought the other geraniums, the hyacinth bulbs in a cracked custard bowl, and the German ivy trained over an old croquet hoop. When these nightly duties were performed, there was nothing left to do but to bring in the tin candlestick from the passage, light the candle, and blow out the lamp. Ethan put the candlestick in Mattie's hand, and she went out of the kitchen ahead of him, the light that she carried before her making her dark hair look like a drift of mist on the moon. "Good night, Matt," he said as she put her foot on the first step of the stairs. She turned and looked at him a moment. "Good night, Ethan," she answered, and went up. When the door of her room had closed on her, he remembered that he had not even touched her hand. End of chapter 5. Chapter 6 of Ethan Frome. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Bob Neufeld. Ethan Frome by Edith Wharton. Chapter 6. The next morning, at breakfast, Jotham Powell was between them, and Ethan tried to hide his joy under an air of exaggerated indifference, lounging back in his chair to throw scraps at the cat, growling at the weather, and not so much as offering to help Matty when she rose to clear away the dishes. He did not know why he was so irrationally happy, for nothing was changed in his life or hers. He had not even touched the tip of her fingers or looked her full in the eyes, but their evening together had given him a vision of what life at her side might be, and he was glad now that he had done nothing to trouble the sweetness of the picture. He had a fancy that she knew what had restrained him. There was a last load of lumber to be hauled to the village, and Jotham Powell, who did not work regularly for Ethan in winter, had come round to help with the job. but a wet snow, melting to sleet, had fallen in the night, and turned the roads to glass. There was more wet in the air, and it seemed likely to both men that the weather would milden toward afternoon and make the going safer. Ethan therefore proposed to his assistant that they should load the sledge at the woodlot, as they had done on the previous morning, and put off the teaming to Starkfield till later in the day. This plan had the advantage of enabling him to send Jotham to the flats after dinner to meet Zenobia, while he himself took the lumber down to the village. He told Jotham to go out and harness up the grays, and for a moment he and Mattie had the kitchen to themselves. She had plunged the breakfast dishes into a tin dishpan, and was bending above it with her slim arms bared to the elbow. The steam from the hot water beading her forehead and tightening her rough hair into little brown rings like the tendrils on the traveler's joy. Ethan stood looking at her, his heart in his throat. He wanted to say, "We shall never be alone again like this." Instead, he reached down his tobacco pouch from a shelf of the dresser, put it into his pocket, and said, "I guess I can make out to be home for dinner." She answered, "All right, Ethan," and he heard her singing over the dishes as he went. As soon as the sledge was loaded, he meant to send Jotham back to the farm and hurry on foot into the village to buy the glue for the pickle dish. With ordinary luck, he should have had time to carry out his plan, but everything went wrong from the start. On the way over to the woodlot, one of the grays slipped on a glare of ice and cut his knee, and when they got him up again, Jotham had to go back to the barn for a strip of rag to bind the cut. Then, when the loading finally began, the sleety rain was coming down once more, and the tree trunks were so slippery that it took twice as long as usual to lift them and get them in place on the sledge. It was what Jotham called a sour morning for work, and the horses, shivering and stamping under their wet blankets, seemed to like it as little as the men. It was long past the dinner hour when the job was done, and Ethan had to give up going to the village because he wanted to lead the injured horse home and wash the cut himself. He thought that by starting out again with the lumber as soon as he had finished his dinner, he might get back to the farm with the glue before Jotham and the old sorrel had had time to fetch Zenobia from the flats. But he knew the chance was a slight one. It turned on the state of the roads and on the possible lateness of the Bettsbridge train. He remembered afterward, with a grim flash of self-derision, what importance he had attached to the weighing of these probabilities. As soon as dinner was over, he set out again for the woodlot, not daring to linger till Jotham Powell left. The hired man was still drying his wet feet at the stove, and Ethan could only give Mattie a quick look as he said beneath his breath, "I'll be back early." He fancied that she nodded her comprehension, and with that scant solace he had to trudge off through the rain. He had driven his load halfway to the village when Jotham Powell overtook him, urging the reluctant sorrel toward the flat. "I'll have to hurry up to do it," Ethan mused as the sleigh dropped down ahead of him over the dip of the schoolhouse hill. He worked like 10 at the unloading, and when it was over, hastened on to Michael Edie's for the glue. Edie and his assistant were both down street, and young Dennis, who seldom deigned to take their place, was lounging by the stove with a knot of the golden youth of Starkfield. They hailed Ethan with ironic compliment and offers of conviviality, but no one knew where to find the glue. Ethan, consumed with longing for a last moment alone with Mattie, hung about impatiently while Dennis made an ineffectual search in the obscurer corners of the store. "Looks as if we're all sold out. But if you'll wait around till the old man comes along, maybe he can put his hand on it."
"I'm obliged to you, but I'll try if I can get it down at Mrs. Homan's," Ethan answered, burning to be gone.
Dennis's commercial instinct compelled him to aver on oath that what Edie's store could not produce would never be found at the Widow Homan's. But Ethan, heedless of this boast, had already climbed to the sledge and was driving on to the rival establishment. Here, after considerable search and sympathetic questions as to what he wanted it for, and whether ordinary flour paste wouldn't do as well if she couldn't find it, the widow Homan finally hunted down her solitary bottle of glue to its hiding place in a medley of cough lozenges and corset laces. "I hope Zina ain't broken anything she set store by," she called after him, as he turned the grays toward home. The fitful bursts of sleet had changed into a steady rain, and the horses had heavy work even without a load behind them. Once or twice, hearing sleigh bells, Ethan turned his head, fancying that Zina and Jotham might overtake him. But the old sorrel was not in sight, and he set his face against the rain and urged on his ponderous pair. The barn was empty when the horses turned into it, and after giving them the most perfunctory ministrations they had ever received from him, he strode up to the house and pushed open the kitchen door. Mattie was there alone, as he had pictured her. She was bending over a pan on the stove, but at the sound of his step she turned with a start and sprang to him. "See here, Matt, I've got some stuff to mend the dish with. Let me get at it, quick," he cried, waving the bottle in one hand while he put her lightly aside. But she did not seem to hear him. "Oh, Ethan, Zina's come," she said in a whisper, clutching his sleeve. They stood and stared at each other, pale as culprits. "But the sorrel's not in the barn," Ethan stammered. "Jotham Powell brought some goods over from the flats for his wife, and he drove right on home with them," she explained. He gazed blankly about the kitchen, which looked cold and squalid in the rainy winter twilight. "How is she?" he asked, dropping his voice to Mattie's whisper. She looked away from him uncertainly.
"I don't know. She went right up to her room."
"She didn't say anything?"
"No."
Ethan let out his doubts in a low whistle and thrust the bottle back into his pocket.
"Don't fret. I'll come down and mend it in the night," he said.
He pulled on his wet coat again and went back to the barn to feed the grays. While he was there, Jotham Powell drove up with the sleigh, and when the horses had been attended to, Ethan said to him, "You might as well come back up for a bite." He was not sorry to assure himself of Jotham's neutralizing presence at the supper table, for Zina was always nervous after a journey. But the hired man, though seldom loath to accept a meal not included in his wages, opened his stiff jaws to answer slowly,
"I'm obliged to you, but I guess I'll go along back."
Ethan looked at him in surprise.
"You better come up and dry off. Looks as if there'd be something hot for supper."
Jotham's facial muscles were unmoved by this appeal, and, his vocabulary being limited, he merely repeated, "I guess I'll go along back." To Ethan there was something vaguely ominous in this stolid rejection of free food and warmth, and he wondered what had happened on the drive to nerve Jotham to such stoicism. Perhaps Zina had failed to see the new doctor, or had not liked his counsels. Ethan knew that in such cases the first person she met was likely to be held responsible for her grievance. When he re-entered the kitchen, the lamp lit up the same scene of shining comfort as on the previous evening. The table had been as carefully laid, a clear fire glowed in the stove, the cat dozed in its warmth, and Mattie came forward carrying a plate of doughnuts. She and Ethan looked at each other in silence. Then she said, as she had said the night before,
"I guess it's about time for supper."
End of chapter 6. Chapter 7 of Ethan Frome. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Bob Neufeld. Ethan Frome by Edith Wharton. Chapter 7. Ethan went out into the passage to hang up his wet garments. He listened for Zina's step, and not hearing it, called her name up the stairs. She did not answer, and after a moment's hesitation, he went up and opened her door. The room was almost dark, but in the obscurity he saw her sitting by the window, bolt upright, and knew by the rigidity of the outline projected against the pane that she had not taken off her traveling dress. "Well, Zina?" he ventured from the threshold. She did not move, and he continued. "Supper's about ready. Ain't you coming?" She replied, "I don't feel as if I could touch a morsel." It was the consecrated formula, and he expected it to be followed, as usual, by her rising and going down to supper. But she remained seated, and he could think of nothing more felicitous than, "I presume you're tired after the long ride." Turning her head at this, she answered solemnly, "I'm a great deal sicker than you think." Her words fell on his ear with a strange shock of wonder. He had often heard her pronounce them before. What if at last they were true? He advanced a step or two into the dim room. "I hope that's not so, Zina," he said. She continued to gaze at him through the twilight with a mien of wan authority, as of one consciously singled out for a great fate. "I've got complications," she said. Ethan knew the word for one of exceptional import. Almost everybody in the neighborhood had troubles, frankly localized and specified, but only the chosen had complications. To have them was in itself a distinction, though it was also, in most cases, a death warrant. People struggled on for years with troubles, but they almost always succumbed to complications. Ethan's heart was jerking to and fro between two extremities of feeling, but for the moment compassion prevailed. His wife looked so hard and lonely, sitting there in the darkness with such thoughts. "Is that what the new doctor told you?" he asked, instinctively lowering his voice. "Yes. He says any regular doctor would want me to have an operation." Ethan was aware that, in regard to the important question of surgical intervention, the female opinion of the neighborhood was divided, some glorying in the prestige conferred by operations, while others shunned them as indelicate. Ethan, from motives of economy, had always been glad that Zina was of the latter faction. In the agitation caused by the gravity of her announcement, he sought a consolatory shortcut. "Oh, what do you know about this doctor, anyway? Nobody ever told you that before." He saw his blunder before she could take it up. She wanted sympathy, not consolation. "I didn't need to have anybody tell me I was losing ground every day. Everybody but you could see it. And everybody in Bettsbridge knows about Dr. Buck. He has his office in Worcester, and comes over once a fortnight to Shadd's Falls and Bettsbridge for consultations. Eliza Spears was wasting away with kidney trouble before she went to him, and now she's up and around, and singing in the choir." "Well, I'm glad of it. You must do just what he tells you," Ethan answered sympathetically. She was still looking at him. "I mean to," she said. He was struck by a new note in her voice. It was neither whining nor reproachful, but dryly resolute. "What does he want you should do?" he asked, with a mounting vision of fresh expenses. "He wants I should have a hired girl. He says I oughtn't to have to do a single thing around the house." "A hired girl?" Ethan stood transfixed. "Yes, and Aunt Martha found me one right off. Everybody said I was lucky to get a girl to come away out here, and I agreed to give her a dollar extry to make sure. She'll be over tomorrow afternoon." Wrath and dismay contended in Ethan. He had foreseen an immediate demand for money, but not a permanent drain on his scant resources. He no longer believed what Zina had told him of the supposed seriousness of her state. He saw in her expedition to Bettsbridge only a plot hatched between herself and her fierce relations to foist on him the cost of a servant, and for the moment wrath predominated.
"If you meant to engage a girl, you ought to have told me before you started," he said.
"How could I tell you before I started? How did I know what Dr. Buck would say?"
"Oh, Dr. Buck!"
Ethan's incredulity escaped in a short laugh.
"Did Dr. Buck tell you how I was going to pay her wages?"
Her voice rose furiously with his.
"No, he didn't, for I'd have been ashamed to tell him that you grudged me the money to get back my health when I lost it nursing your own mother." "You lost your health nursing mother?" "Yes, and my folks all told me at the time you couldn't do no less than marry me after Zina."
Through the obscurity which hid their faces, their thoughts seemed to dart at each other like serpents shooting venom. Ethan was seized with horror of the scene, and shame at his own share in it. It was as senseless and savage as a physical fight between two enemies in the darkness. He turned to the shelf above the chimney, groped for matches, and lit the one candle in the room. At first its weak flame made no impression on the shadows. Then Zina's face stood grimly out against the uncurtained pane, which had turned from gray to black. It was the first scene of open anger between the couple in their sad 7 years together, and Ethan felt as if he had lost an irretrievable advantage in descending to the level of recrimination. But the practical problem was there, and had to be dealt with.
"You know I haven't got the money to pay for a girl, Zina. You'll have to send her back. I can't do it."
"The doctor says it'll be my death if I go on slaving the way I've had to. He doesn't understand how I've stood it as long as I have."
"Slaving?"
He checked himself again.
"You shan't lift a hand if he says so. I'll do everything round the house myself."
She broke in,
"You're neglecting the farm enough already."
And this being true, he found no answer, and left her time to add ironically,
"Better send me over to the almshouse and done with it. I guess there's been Fromes there afore now."
The taunt burned into him, but he let it pass.
"I haven't got the money. That settles it."
There was a moment's pause in the struggle, as though the combatants were testing their weapons. Then Zina said in a level voice,
"I thought you were to get $50 from Andrew Hale for that lumber."
"Andrew Hale never pays under 3 months."
He had hardly spoken when he remembered the excuse he had made for not accompanying his wife to the station the day before, and the blood rose to his frowning brows.
"Why, you told me yesterday you'd fixed it up with him to pay cash down. You said that was why you couldn't drive me over to the flats."
Ethan had no suppleness in deceiving. He had never before been convicted of a lie, and all the resources of evasion failed him.
"I guess that was a misunderstanding," he stammered.
"You ain't got the money?"
"No."
"And you ain't going to get it?"
"No."
"Well, I couldn't know that when I engaged the girl, could I?"
"No."
He paused to control his voice.
"But you know it now. I'm sorry, but it can't be helped. You're a poor man's wife, Zina, but I'll do the best I can for you."
For a while she sat motionless, as if reflecting, her arms stretched along the arms of her chair, her eyes fixed on vacancy.
"Oh, I guess we'll make out," she said mildly.
The change in her tone reassured him.
"Of course we will. There's a whole lot more I can do for you. And Matty..."
Zina, while he spoke, seemed to be following out some elaborate mental calculation. She emerged from it to say, There'll be Matty's board less, anyhow."
Ethan, supposing the discussion to be over, had turned to go down to supper. He stopped short, not grasping what he heard.
"Matty's board less?" he began.
Zina laughed. It was an odd, unfamiliar sound. He did not remember ever having heard her laugh before.
"You didn't suppose I was going to keep two girls, did you? No wonder you were scared at the expense."
He still had but a confused sense of what she was saying. From the beginning of the discussion, he had instinctively avoided the mention of Matty's name, fearing he hardly knew what. Criticisms, complaints, or vague allusions to the imminent probability of her marrying. But the thought of a definite rupture had never come to him, and even now could not lodge itself in his mind.
"I don't know what you mean."
"Matty Silver's not a hired girl. She's your relation. She's a pauper that hung onto us all after her father done his best to ruin us. I've kept her here a whole year. It's somebody else's turn now."
As the shrill words shot out, Ethan heard a tap on the door, which he had drawn shut when he turned back from the threshold.
"Ethan! Zina!" Matty's voice sounded gaily from the landing. "Do you know what time it is? Supper's been ready half an hour."
Inside the room there was a moment's silence. Then Zina called out from her seat,
"I'm not coming down to supper."
"Oh, I'm sorry. Aren't you well? Shan't I bring you up a bite of something?"
Ethan roused himself with an effort and opened the door.
"Go along down, Matt. Zina's just a little tired. I'm coming."
He heard her, "All right," and her quick step on the stairs. Then he shut the door and turned back into the room. His wife's attitude was unchanged, her face inexorable, and he was seized with the despairing sense of his helplessness.
"You ain't gonna do it, Zina."
"Do what?"
she emitted from flattened lips.
"Send Matty away, like this."
"I never bargained to take her for life,"
he continued with rising vehemence.
"You can't put her out of the house like a thief, a poor girl without friends or money. She's done her best for you. She's got no place to go to. You may forget she's your kin, but everybody else'll remember it. If you do a thing like that, what do you suppose folks'll say of you?"
Zina waited a moment, as if giving him time to feel the full force of the contrast between his own excitement and her composure. Then she replied in the same smooth voice,
"I know well enough what they say of my having kept her here as long as I have."
Ethan's hand dropped from the doorknob, which he had held clenched since he had drawn the door shut on Matty. His wife's retort was like a knife cut across the sinews, and he felt suddenly weak and powerless. He had meant to humble himself, to argue that Matty's keep didn't cost much, after all, that he could make out to buy a stove and fix up a place in the attic for the hired girl. But Zina's words revealed the peril of such pleadings.
"You mean to tell her she's got to go, at once,"
he faltered out, in terror of letting his wife complete her sentence. As if trying to make him see reason, she replied impartially,
"The girl will be over from Bettsbridge tomorrow, and I presume she's got to have somewheres to sleep."
Ethan looked at her with loathing. She was no longer the listless creature who had lived at his side in a state of sullen self-absorption, but a mysterious alien presence, an evil energy secreted from the long years of silent brooding. It was the sense of his helplessness that sharpened his antipathy. There had never been anything in her that one could appeal to, but as long as he could ignore and command, he had remained indifferent. Now she had mastered him, and he abhorred her. Matty was her relation, not his. There were no means by which he could compel her to keep the girl under her roof. All the long misery of his baffled past, of his youth of failure, hardship, and vain effort, rose up in his soul in bitterness, and seemed to take shape before him in the woman who at every turn had barred his way. She had taken everything else from him, and now she meant to take the one thing that made up for all the others. For a moment such a flame of hate rose in him that it ran down his arms and clenched his fist against her. He took a wild step forward, and then stopped. "You're not coming down?" he said in a bewildered voice. "No. I guess I'll lay down on the bed a little while," she answered mildly, and he turned and walked out of the room. In the kitchen, Mattie was sitting by the stove, the cat curled up on her knees. She sprang to her feet as Ethan entered, and carried the covered dish of meat pie to the table. "I hope Zina isn't sick?" she asked. "No." She shone at him across the table. "Well, sit right down, then. You must be starving." She uncovered the pie and pushed it over to him. So they were to have one more evening together, her happy eyes seemed to say. He helped himself mechanically and began to eat. Then disgust took him by the throat, and he laid down his fork. Mattie's tender gaze was on him, and she marked the gesture. "Why, Ethan, what's the matter? Don't it taste right?" "Yes, it's first rate. Only I..." He pushed his plate away, rose from his chair, and walked around the table to her side. She started up with frightened eyes. "Ethan, there's something wrong. I knew there was." She seemed to melt against him in her terror, and he caught her in his arms, held her fast there, felt her lashes beat his cheek like netted butterflies. "What is it?" she stammered. But he had found her lips at last, and was drinking unconsciousness of everything but the joy they gave him. She lingered a moment, caught in the same strong current. Then she slipped from him and drew back a step or two, pale and troubled. Her look smote him with compunction, and he cried out, as if he saw her drowning in a dream, "You can't go, Matt. I'll never let you." "Go?" she stammered. "Must I go?" The words went on sounding between them as though a torch of warning flew from hand to hand through a black landscape. Ethan was overcome with shame at his lack of self-control in flinging the news at her so brutally. His head reeled, and he had to support himself against the table. All the while he felt as if he were still kissing her, and yet dying of thirst for her lips. "Ethan, what has happened? Is Zina mad with me?" Her cry steadied him, though it deepened his wrath and pity. "No, no," he assured her, "it's not that. But this new doctor has scared her about herself. You know she believes all they say the first time she sees them, and this one's told her she won't get well unless she lays up and don't do a thing about the house. Not for months." He paused, his eyes wandering from her miserably. She stood silent a moment, drooping before him like a broken branch. She was so small and weak-looking that it wrung his heart. But suddenly she lifted her head and looked straight at him. "And she wants somebody handier in my place. Is that it?" "That's what she says tonight." "If she says it tonight, she'll say it tomorrow." Both bowed to the inexorable truth. They knew that Zina never changed her mind, and that in her case a resolve once taken was equivalent to an act performed. There was a long silence between them. Then Mattie said in a low voice, "Don't be too sorry, Ethan." "Oh, God," he groaned. The glow of passion he had felt for her had melted to an aching tenderness. He saw her quick lids beating back the tears, and longed to take her in his arms and soothe her.
"You're letting your supper get cold,"
she admonished him with a pale gleam of gaiety.
"Matt, where'll you go to?"
Her lids sank, and a tremor crossed her face. He saw that for the first time the thought of the future came to her distinctly.
"I might get something to do over at Stamford," she faltered, as if knowing that he knew she had no hope.
He dropped back into his seat and hid his face in his hands. Despair seized him at the thought of her setting out alone to renew the weary quest for work. In the only place where she was known, she was surrounded by indifference or animosity. And what chance had she, inexperienced and untrained, among the million bread-seekers of the cities? There came back to him miserable tales as he had heard at Worcester, and the faces of girls whose lives had begun as hopefully as Matty's. It was not possible to think of such things without a revolt of his whole being. He sprang up suddenly.
You can't go, Matt. I won't let you. She's always had her way, but I mean to have mine now.
Matty lifted her hand with a quick gesture, and he heard his wife's step behind him. Zina came into the room with her dragging down at the heel step, and quietly took her accustomed seat between them.
"I felt a little mite better, and Dr. Buck says I ought to eat all I can to keep my strength up, even if I ain't got any appetite,"
she said in her flat whine, reaching across Matty for the teapot. Her good dress had been replaced by the black calico and brown knitted shawl which formed her daily wear, and with them she had put on her usual face and manner. She poured out her tea, added a great deal of milk to it, helped herself largely to pie and pickles, and made the familiar gesture of adjusting her false teeth before she began to eat. The cat rubbed itself ingratiatingly against her, and she said, "Good pussy," stooped to stroke it, and gave it a scrap of meat from her plate. Ethan sat speechless, not pretending to eat, but Matty nibbled valiantly at her food and asked Zina one or two questions about her visit to Bettsbridge. Zina answered in her everyday tone, and, warming to the theme, regaled them with several vivid descriptions of intestinal disturbances among her friends and relatives. She looked straight at Matty as she spoke, a faint smile deepening the vertical lines between her nose and chin. When supper was over, she rose from her seat and pressed her hand to the flat surface over the region of her heart.
"That pie of yours always sets a mite heavy, Matt," she said, not ill-naturedly.
She seldom abbreviated the girl's name, and when she did so, it was always a sign of affability.
"I've a good mind to go and hunt up those stomach powders I got last year over in Springfield," she continued. "I ain't tried them for quite a while, and maybe they'll help the heartburn."
Matty lifted her eyes.
"Can't I get them for you, Zina?" she ventured.
"No, they're in a place you don't know about," Zina answered darkly, with one of her secret looks. She went out of the kitchen, and Matty, rising, began to clear the dishes from the table. As she passed Ethan's chair, their eyes met and clung together desolately. The warm, still kitchen looked as peaceful as the night before. The cat had sprung to Zina's rocking chair, and the heat of the fire was beginning to draw out the faint, sharp scent of the geraniums. Ethan dragged himself wearily to his feet.
"I'll go out and take a look around," he said, going toward the passage to get his lantern.
As he reached the door, he met Zina coming back into the room, her lips twitching with anger, a flush of excitement on her sallow face. The shawl had slipped from her shoulders and was dragging at her downtrodden heels, and in her hands she carried the fragments of the red glass pickle dish.
"I'd like to know who done this," she said, looking sternly from Ethan to Matty.
There was no answer, and she continued in a trembling voice,
"I went to get those powders I'd put away in father's old spectacle case, top of the china closet, where I keep the things I set store by, so folks shan't meddle with them."
Her voice broke, and two small tears hung on her lashless lids and ran slowly down her cheeks.
"It takes a stepladder to get at the top shelf, and I put Anne Falloura Maple's pickle dish up there on purpose when we were married, and it's never been down since, except for spring cleaning, and then I always lifted it with my own hands so's it shouldn't get broke."
She laid the fragments reverently on the table.
"I want to know who done this," she quavered.
At the challenge, Ethan turned back into the room and faced her.
"I can tell you, then. The cat done it."
"The cat?"
"That's what I said."
She looked at him hard, and then turning her eyes to Matty, who was carrying the dishpan to the table,
"I'd like to know how the cat got into my china closet," she said.
"Chasing mice, I guess," Ethan rejoined. "There was a mouse around the kitchen all last evening."
Zina continued to look from one to the other. Then she emitted her small, strange laugh.
"Ah, I knew the cat was a smart cat," she said in a high voice, "but I didn't know he was smart enough to pick up the pieces of my pickle dish and lay 'em edge to edge on the very shelf he knocked 'em off of."
Matty suddenly drew her arms out of the steaming water.
"It wasn't Ethan's fault, Zina. The cat did break the dish, but I got it down from the china closet, and I'm the one to blame for its getting broken."
Zina stood beside the ruin of her treasure, stiffening into a stony image of resentment.
"You cut down my pickle dish? What for?"
A bright flush flew to Matty's cheeks.
"I wanted to make the supper table pretty," she said. "You wanted to make the supper table pretty, and you waited till my back was turned and took the thing I set most store by of anything I've got, and wouldn't never use it, not even when the minister came to dinner or Aunt Martha Pierce came over from Bettsbridge."
Zina paused with a gasp, as if terrified by her own evocation of the sacrilege.
"You're a bad girl, Matty Silver, and I always known it. It's the way your father begun, and I was warned of it when I took you, and I tried to keep my things where you couldn't get at 'em, and now you've took from me the one I cared for most of all."
She broke off in a short spasm of sobs that passed and left her more than ever like a shape of stone.
"If I'd a listened to folks, you'd a' gone before now, and this wouldn't a' happened," she said.
And gathering up the bits of broken glass, she went out of the room as if she carried a dead body. End of chapter 7.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.